Welcome to If These Ovaries Could Talk. I'm Jamie.
I'm Robin.
And we're your hosts.
We sure are. Love is love. If you don't have to make a family by taking a traditional ride. If these ovaries could talk, you would say. How do I get the sperm through custom?
I am a lesbian.
So gay.
We need to tell our story.
It's not your nuclear family anymore. It's not just your mom and dad thing.
We're not ruining these little humans.
Not for the gay reason. Just because we stick.
Oh, you guys. Hi.
Hi.
All right. Before we get into things, can we please talk about the event we went to last week for the You Gotta Believe
Org? You Gotta Believe.
I mean, you guys.
Making sure foster children don't age out.
Yeah, that's their mission.
Home. Yeah.
You remember Mother Mary from last year.
How could you not remember Mother Mary? If you didn't listen to Mother Mary's episode, go back. Listen to her. She's this woman who fostered how many children?
800 million.
She's like the old lady who lives in a shoe. We joked about that in the podcast. Mm-hmm. She is like, the whole time she's talking to us, we knew her as Mary. And then I said, can we call you Mother Mary? She said, everybody calls me that because she just has this vibe.
Oh, she's amazing.
She's so loving and accepting and patient and kind. Like, she's literally Mother Mary.
And so we went to, they did a, Seth Radetzky, who you also remember from our podcast, and his husband, James Wesley.
And his husband, James Wesley.
So they put on a benefit. It's like a Broadway benefit with Broadway stars for You Gotta Believe. And Mary, Mother Mary invited us with our wives. So we got like sitters and we went out on the town.
We had a date night. We had a double date. We did.
And
it was
and
fun.
That was so powerful.
We sat down in the theater and I said, prepare to cry. We're going to cry. And she was like, no, we're not. Why would we cry?
I didn't say that. I was like,
Anne who said, why would we cry?
But
you
cry.
Said, no, but you were like, we'll see. Yeah. I don't know what you said.
I just said, yeah.
I don't know if you were feeling. No, you weren't feeling the crying. Like, I was
I'm a crier. I cry at these things.
Guys, Robin saw. I was afraid to look over at her because, like, I was like, oh, my God, is she really sobbing that hard? I wasn't sure. Or if you just had a cold.
Streaming down my face during the entire thing. I mean, these stories.
I know. Really. Lori Metcalf, who you know, I mean, who I remember as Jackie from Roseanne, but she does
greatest
so
actress
much
ever.
More. I mean, she's so amazing. Yeah. She got up and spoke. I didn't even know that she was a foster mom.
It was so powerful.
Her story was beautiful. Ugh, so many people.
Oh, I went home and told my kids about the stories because I was just like, you guys have no idea how lucky you are.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, I went home and was telling them about that one girl whose foster parents locked the food up.
Oh, my God.
With padlocks,
that.
And only their natural-born kids got the keys.
Yeah.
And my kids were just like, staring blank-faced at me, oh, my God.
Like a evil fairy tale.
Disgusting.
Like, that actually happens. No, there's so many terrible things out there. But then there's good foster parents as well, which is what this event highlighted. Yeah. And the ones who become these children's forever homes, even when they're 16, 17, 18, 22, she got adopted finally. And it just matters so much because when you think about these foster kids, they're in the system so long, they don't have an example of what a family is.
Mm-mm.
They don't have a blueprint. You know, our kids are so lucky they have a blueprint of what you do and they have us to help them get a bank account, get a self, like all these things that you need parental help.
Right. Apply to college.
Apply to high school. Middle school.
But you gotta check out You Gotta Believe and donate to them and look into their organization. Their website is yougottabelieve.org. They're just such an incredible. We could talk for hours, but we're not going to.
Bring them back on, I guess.
I know. Oh, jeez. Okay, one more item of business before we introduce our guests. We did a guest spot last week.
Sure did.
On the I Love My Wife podcast,
they're
which is
so
Kelly
funny,
and Anne.
Those ladies.
Oh, my God, I love them so much. And they're part of the DNR network, you know, Derek and Romaine's show, that
Studios
network.
We use now.
Yes, and we're kind of a part of that network, too.
We've joined the family.
Yeah, go check it out, you guys.
check it out. No, it's really fun. It was really fun to talk to them.
Yeah.
They're easy to talk to.
Anywho. Okay. Let's talk about our guest for today.
Wow, this lady. We had such a deep conversation with this woman. Mm-hmm.
Well, her name is Sarah Stevens.
Sarah Stevens.
Okay, and she's the founder of The Beautiful Project. And the organization helps women write new endings to stories they believe about their bodies, inviting them to take up space in every area of their lives. Isn't that a great freaking mission statement?
Yeah, I mean, when we got into the whole body topic. We could have we talked way longer than we had planned, first of all.
For sure.
And we could have talked to her for, I think, another 2 hours.
Yeah.
Because who doesn't have, what woman in this world doesn't have a body issue or, you know.
Well, not me, Jamie.
Not at all. Not at all.
So many issues. But she also talked about her non-traditional family and the creation of it. She was married to a man. And should we go to the interview?
It's a really great story, guys.
Go to the interview.
Get it.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Sarah.
Oh, my God.
Nice to see you.
Welcome all the way from, where are you at?
I am in Iowa. I just feel like there should be an explanation for that, but it's just the reality. I'm in Iowa.
So, Sarah, are you from Iowa originally?
I live on the border of Iowa and Illinois. We live in this little space called the Quad Cities, and so it's four cities. Well, I use city loosely, but it's four city-ish is that they put together. And so we're right on the Mississippi. So I actually live in Illinois and work in Iowa, but for us here, it's like all one state, honestly, but it's not.
Oh, that's so,
wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's something. Yeah. So I have been here most of my life. I didn't intend to stay. I came back when we were raising babies and I was like, it's going to be a brief stop. And that was 18 years ago. So yeah.
And yeah, then here
very
you go.
Stuck.
Brief.
The babies, it's kind of like stick you where you are.
I feel like you're doing a very, you're a podcaster, which we can tell you're doing a very natural transition into our elevator pitch.
Yes. Thank you.
Hold on. On your mark, get set, go.
So we are a two-mom, three-teenager household. We also have an 8-pound epileptic Maltese that I feel like needs to be mentioned because the epilepsy makes him extra, well, just extra. my wife and I have been together for 6 years. We're a blended family. So these are children from my marriage to my ex-husband. She came on the scene and we have been in the difficult part of teenage parenting. We've done it together. We're committed to staying in it.
Beautiful.
Oh, you did it right at the
time.
It was like so perfect.
It was a lot, guys, but I managed.
I'm so really? Impressed Thanks. By you.
You didn't even seem nervous. You didn't even seem like, Oof. You didn't even seem worried
well,
at all.
It was in my
I
head.
Think I was more nervous for you than
It was
than
that
you
5-second yeah. countdown. I was like, I've got 7 sentences left to say in 5 seconds, but that's cool. We can do that.
Well, the beauty is now we have
now
like,
we can
you know,
dig in.
40 minutes for you to actually
Perfect.
Finish.
Firstly, I'd like to know your dog's name.
He's Max, the Maltese. Sometimes
Max the
yeah,
Maltese.
Sometimes I call him Maxwell. I don't know. Yeah.
Because you do.
All right. Well, so tell us about your family. Where did it start? And how'd you make your kids and your two-mom family? And
it's not a linear story at all. So I met my now ex-husband in my last year of college. We were both from a pretty religious background. We were going to a very conservative Catholic college, which feels like when I say that out loud, I have a little like dissociation, like whose life was that? But it was mine. So we met at this Catholic college. We actually got pregnant with our daughter within a couple of months, which was, in case anybody was wondering,
Ooh, wow,
not real popular at the super Catholic college.
Oh, you weren't married yet.
We were not married. No. Oops. So
atta girl.
Yeah. You know, go big or go home, apparently. So we had Alana. We got married. We had 3 kids pretty quickly. So Alana was born in 02, Aiden in 03, Gabe in 05. So my now ex-husband, and this part gets fuzzy too. That's part of my problem with retelling it because honestly, there was a significant amount of trauma through this phase of my life as well. But somewhere I was pregnant with Gabe, I'm pretty sure. So 3 little kids. I was a part-time stay-at-home mom, part-time youth minister. And my ex-husband was in sales and he came home one day and said he didn't really want to live anymore. So he went through this pretty deep mental health crisis and I had 3 little people, very little people at home. And in the process of sort of digging what was underneath that, what he disclosed to me is that he had been serially unfaithful in our marriage for years. Yes. Yeah.
Oh, and you had no idea?
No. You know, it's that intuition thing. There was no reason on the outside to think that was the case. we were in so many ways like the, I use air quotes here, like good Catholic family, unquote. So I was popping out kids, praying rosaries, like a whole different life. Like, it's so weird for me to say, but,
popping out kids and praying rosaries. That's the name of this episode.
That's the name of your
autobiography. Popping out kids and praying rosaries. Actually, that is probably pretty good. I feel like you should use
or
that.
Or the name of your autobiography. Yeah.
So he discloses all of this to me. And I would love to say that I was like this empowered woman who said, leave, but I had no means of making an income, really. I was a part-time youth minister. They don't make any money. Mm-hmm. I either was pregnant with Gabe or had had Gabe. Honestly, super fuzzy trauma response to this whole phase of my life. But we tried to work on it for a year. And I don't even really know what that means other than we were just in therapy a lot. But in the course of that time, he continued to disclose details. And ultimately, the thing that I didn't mention is that Jason was serially unfaithful with men. And so, yeah. Ooh.
Well, that would explain the why he didn't want to
precisely,
live any longer,
yeah,
probably.
And that Jason and I are actually friends today. That was a lot of work as well, a lot of healing. Mm. But I can today find some space in me for some empathy around the kind of burden that was for him too. You know, we were really young, and we both had a lot of external forces on us that said, "This is the way you live." And the way that Jason's truth manifested in our relationship was extremely damaging and painful to me and to our children. But I know that wasn't his intention. It's just the reality of where he was at in his life. So, you know, some people hear our story and they're like, oh, he's gay, you're gay. It sounds so lovely. It's like a parlor trick.
Yeah.
And like it was just this clean love. Yeah. No, people really do say some weird shit in response to that part of the story, just so you know. So I had a 4, 3 and newborn, 4-year-old, 3-year-old newborn.
Oh my God. I was
making $11,000 a year. And, so I walked through the experience of losing everything. We lost our home, our car. I mean, we lost everything we had put together as a family.
Wow.
And those are some pretty dark years for me of deconstructing pretty much everything I believed to be true, because that's what it felt like to me.
Well, can I ask, like, did you know you were gay at this point? And like, was that part of the conversation?
No.
Or it was just, he's leaving you for me.
Yes, it was that. It was Jason's abandoning his family. That was really the narrative, right? But you know, about my own sexuality, I think in hindsight, I know a lot more now when I look at it. I remember being attracted to women when I was young. And I remember not making a choice, not feeling like there was a choice. It wasn't even that felt like a choice to me. I just, and I'm a badass compartmentalizer. So I was just like, oh, well, what is that oddity? I'm going to have to package that away somewhere in order to have the belonging that I'm looking for.
Yeah. It's amazing what these external forces can do to us.
So powerful.
It's just mind-boggling.
So powerful. And when I think about it, my family, they actually weren't overtly religious. I kind of go big or go home about everything. So I had been raised in this Catholic family. And I was like, well, if we're going to be this, and we're going to be this all the way, which is kind of where that extreme expression of living in that religious context came from. So my family, the issue wasn't even so much a religious thing. I still don't quite get the resistance, other than I knew for sure I would cease to belong if that was my reality. If I said out loud, I love women, I wouldn't belong anymore. And man, belonging is so attached to our sense of survival.
I had such a similar thing too. I remember thinking, cause I didn't come out till after college. And I remember thinking, I had all these friends that had become my family because my family life wasn't, you know, amazing. And I remember thinking, well, I guess I'll just like move to New York and maybe I'll be gay, but I'm going to give up all my friends because I didn't think I could ever see a world where I could be loved by people. I just had so much shame around it. And so it's like similar to what you're saying. And now I got this big gay podcast.
Now you're super gay.
So gay. Biggest gayest
thing. That is
thing
pretty
ever.
Gay, yeah.
I'm wearing sweatpants and my Atari t-shirt
She's
today.
So gay today. So gay.
Anyway, back to you.
Let me think. Okay. So that place in my life was entirely about survival. I had 3 small people who were dependent on me. I had no way to really make a living. So my first order of business was not about who I wanted to fall in love with. It was, how do I feed them?
Yeah. So I know you said Jason disappeared. Does that mean he also, like, money disappeared? Like, he didn't send you any money? He didn't?
Yeah. I started working at a frontline job in corporate healthcare. I was registering patients in the ER. But about a year after I took that job, they approached me and said, you're overqualified for this and you've got natural leadership skill. Yeah.
You were like, you think?
Welcome to my entire fucking reality. Thank you. But so they tapped me and said, would you like to be in a leadership role? And I said, yes. And so that was 2008. From 2008 to 2016, I really carved out a career in corporate healthcare. When I left corporate healthcare in 16, I was director of outpatient services, running like $90 million in revenue, and learned how to build a business from that experience. Corporate healthcare also sucked my will to live. But that was brutal. People who stay in are just heroes, honestly. So how I rebuilt the more like temporal, like the things around us, was really through that work. I probably 3 years into that process, when I started to be able to transition out of surviving, right? Like when I knew we would be able to eat next week and pay our rent and pay our car payment, those real basic needs. That was when I started to look at the rest of my life and say, well, what do I want it to look like now? Because I have some choices about that. And I had dated a couple of guys, but it was not there. I mean, it never really was. If I'm really being honest, it never really was there. But it was like, yeah, you're like, what is this? Huh. This is curious.
This is really boring.
And this was the other experience I like to share because it's funny to me now, perplexing to me then. There were these two, there were these two lesbian nurses. Well, one was a nurse, one was a medic, who came into the ER all the time. And this is hilarious.
Yeah. We're already like this. Yeah, well, exactly. What happened?
So I remember being completely confused by why every time they were around, I turned into this like blushing schoolgirl and didn't know how to have a freaking conversation. Like
start twirling your hair,
batting my eyelashes. I'm like, who the fuck am I? What is going on? Right. I had moved into this space of not just surviving anymone and I'd gone out with some work friends at a party, and the medic of the medic and the lesbian nurse, the medic was there. And I met her that night, and she, the easiest way for me to explain this is that she saw something, she saw in me what I was unwilling to see in myself, and she just came after it. Mm-hmm. And I did not resist that, which is also really clear. Like when I think back about that time, that surprises me because I still had some pretty intense like walls up. But she was just relentless, and that relationship was a hot fucking mess. But the thing I will say about it is that I'm so grateful that she just didn't let up, because once the truth was outside of me, I never tried to put it back in. I couldn't. It was like toothpaste back in a tube. I could not unknow what I knew. I was 33. So that relationship ended quickly, I came out right away, though, to my family. And it's so weird to me. Like, in the course of 2 weeks, I was like, I'm straight. And then I was like, no, I'm not. I'm actually gay. And everybody's going to know. And everybody can just fucking deal with it.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was quick.
You are all or nothing.
Yeah, a little bit.
You are all or nothing. Because it took me like 10 years to slowly come out.
So much crying. It was so.
So much crying.
But you also, like, you know, like, I mean, I don't even know. You just knew.
I knew. I couldn't unknow.
Once she knew, she knew.
Yeah.
And it had how'd your family take it?
Very poorly. Yeah. My mom and I used to talk every day. And actually that was sort of a not healthy as well, but little enmeshed there, but whatever. So I told her, and her response to me was that it'd be better if I told her I was dying. So yeah. So we didn't talk for a very long time, almost a year, which for me, that was enormous. But I don't have a real reasonable explanation about how I just persisted in that place, but I just did not look back. So I was like, okay, that isn't my problem.
Well, you had been through so much at that point. I mean, I had to imagine you were just like, you're either with me or you're against me.
Yeah. I just had nothing for it. So I let her go for a year. And the rest of my family was also not great. I did that year very much alone. However, odd part of the story, my ex-husband's whole life fell apart, which is how these things happen. And so he had, in this process at some point, I don't really remember which year, he showed back up on my, actually on my doorstep and said, can I see them? And I was like, yeah, I don't, you know, come back with pizza on Friday. Like, and we'll talk, you know,
and some back yeah. pay. My
yes.
friend.
Oh, lots of money. Please come with a check and a pizza. Yeah. Thank you.
What had been your conversation to the kids about him up to this point?
I probably did a lot of protecting, honestly, of him. Mm-hmm. I wanted, honestly, to this day, Jason and I are friends, but there are still things I wish I wish were different about him as a father. And so I've put in a lot of labor into his relationship with them. And some people are critical.
What makes you a good parent?
Yeah. I sometimes I get some shit for that, you know? And ultimately, if I'm going to err, I'd rather err on the side of generosity on that. I just would, because it's better for them.
It is.
So when he showed back up, it took some time, 6 months or so, but he was like, I could really use a place to live. And could I live in your basement? And I was like, actually, that's a genius idea, because you can pay half the rent and child support. And so for a few years, we actually just co-parented that way. Like, he'd have 3 days a week and he'd come upstairs and be with the kids. And I would go be single-ish or something.
Did you go down to the basement?
I did not. I still stayed in. He would have to sleep. He always had to sleep in the basement. Always in the basement, Jason.
Jason,
get in the basement. Yeah.
Get down there. Get down.
Get down.
Wait. Down, down, boy. Wait. Down, down.
But so he was in the basement. Where were you sleeping? Was it like you had the girlfriend and you were at a girlfriend's house during those days?
No, I would often just sleep in my own, you know, it was a sizable enough house that I could sleep in my own bedroom. But honestly,
but it was like you're in charge of the kids.
Exactly.
During those
days. And I didn't have to like take anybody to the grocery store. I could just leave my house and go whenever I wanted. Nice. So it was amazing, actually.
That sounds nice.
It was actually really lovely. And to be honest, during that year where I felt pretty alone and my family had very much been like, you're going to have to, I don't know, convert back or something. I don't even know what the hell that was. He actually was this, ironically, he was a beautiful support system for me at the time. So that year was hard. I met my first real like long-term girlfriend in that year. And, my family kind of came back around. I've known my wife for, well, this whole time. And she worked at the same health system that I worked at. She's actually the person I reached out to when I was trying to disclose to my kids, because I sought her counsel. I was like, how do I do this? Because they were, I don't know, 11-ish, 12-ish. They were old enough that I would assume it was going to be kind of earth-shattering for them.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry to interrupt, but had you raised them in the Catholic Church?
Not really.
Up to this point? Or not even close to how you had been raised?
There was a definite, even after the divorce, before my coming out, I just had nothing left for the church. It was, I honestly saw so much of how I ended up in this situation as a result, really. It was like an outgrowth of the theology that we were taught about how to be in relationship. And it was damaging and destructive. And honestly, the people in the church were awful. They were when they found out that Jason was with men, they treated the entire family poorly. I was just over it. I was like, I have nothing left.
That'll do
it. Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. So, Jen, right. So I disclosed to my kids, my now wife told me, she said, when I said, how do I do this? She goes, they already know, Sarah. And I was like, they do not know. They do not know, you know? And she was like, I promise they probably already know. So I took them to Applebee's over some riblet baskets. And,
of course, Applebee's.
A little public disclosure. I'm not sure what the hell that was about. Yeah. And,
Compartmentalized.
So I was with Jen at the time and I just told them, I was like, you guys know Jen, and Jen's not just mom's friend, and I love Jen. And I explained that to them. And Alana, my oldest, said, it's about time you told us. So she did actually know. She was maybe 12, 11 or 12, not quite 10. I don't know. Somewhere between 10 and 12. My middle child, Aiden, said the same. He actually knew as well. But Gabe, who was 5 or 6, was like, stared at me for a second. Then he goes, you're telling me you like girls too. Like, that's what you're telling me, right? And actually, like, literally that was it. The thing I feared. I don't know what I feared. I feared more instability for them. They had already been through so much up until that point.
And did they know about their dad's sexuality?
No, I actually came out to the kids before Jason did. No, it took him a couple more years, honestly, before he came out to the kids. So
was that hard for the kids to have two gay parents?
You know,
three.
Yeah, there's so many. Well, and Jason's partner too. So there's just a lot of gay people.
Four?
There's so many gay people.
Let's keep counting. Yeah. Five.
I'm sure there are more, probably closeted. But anyway, Gabe, the youngest, has always struggled more with that. Beck and I will talk about how it took Gabe. Becky's my wife. Gabe had a slumber party 3 years ago where he finally had friends over to the house. And it was like Gabe's coming out party because he finally told all 12 of his friends. Apparently up until that, Becky had been his aunt who was sleeping in the same room as me. Didn't know this.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
And so all 12 of those little boys ran upstairs to our bedroom and like told us how they thought it was okay. And they loved it and they were fine. And it was beautiful. So really Gabe was the one who struggled the most, because for Gabe, it's really about, he doesn't want people to talk shit about his mom. And that is where it comes from for Gabe. But the other two have just been adjusted and their friends are lovely and we don't hide anything. So everybody seems okay-ish. I mean, they're teenagers. It's really fucking hard to tell. But I think it's fine. So I was with Jen for 3 years. And then that relationship ended. And my wife and I had been friends for years, probably 10 years. And that turned into something different. And we've been together 6 years now, married for 3.
Oh,
congratulations.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, she came on the scene at the end of, the kids were 12, 11, and 8. So she got the end of the honeymoon period. So she's been with me through teenage parenting it's just hard. It's hard. And Becky's been here for the hardest part. And Beck and I had to figure out, Beck's 14 years older than I am. And so we come from very different parenting like eras.
Oh, she's all that like, shut up and just be quiet.
Did
like
she
that.
Exactly. Kids?
Listen to me because I said so.
Exactly. Yeah. No, not in my, I mean, yeah. So we've had to do a lot of work around that too.
Did she bring kids to the marriage too?
No, she had never had kids. So I, okay. Yeah.
So she walked into 3 children in their teens.
Atta girl.
She's saint. Amazing. She's amazing. My wife is incredible.
Hey, folks, guess what? We have a new podcast to tell you about called Nursing and Cursing that you got to get on.
It's really fun.
thanks, Jamie.
You're welcome.
So basically, Nursing and Cursing is the parenting podcast that covers what they like to say is more shit than your baby's full diaper.
I get that.
So if you've ever accidentally grabbed a cheese stick out of your purse instead of a tampon.
Done that.
Or you thought about smothering your sleeping husband, or in our case, wives, as your baby wakes up for the 100th time.
Literally last night.
So this podcast, it's hosted by 5 moms, which is incredible. And these guys have been friends since childhood. And each episode, they break down a parenting topic that moms at every age and stage are gonna relate to.
It's true. I just listened to one that the topic is parenting past 7 p.m. and it's the worst thing in the world. Parenting, like it.
At 7 o'clock, I'm always like, at 7 o'clock, I'm always like, I'm off the clock, you guys. You know how I get after 7. You know.
They say it borders on, like, you border on child abuse.
Yeah, it's
like
pretty
good
true.
Parenting to child abuse. Anyway.
And the hosts really between them, they have 10 kids that are ranging in the ages of 2 to 13. So you're going to get a bunch of experiences from infertility to postpartum depression. And these ladies are going to be basically your sister wife spirit guides through the twisted maze of motherhood, which we all know about.
Yeah. And some of the fan favorite episodes include postpartum husband hatred, or in our wives, postpartum wives hatred. I get that. In which the moms analyze exactly what combination of exhaustion and hormones make us turn on our beloved spouses after the babies are born. And then they also have an episode
called Mom Guilt,
which discusses why the feelings of failing is so universal in motherhood and how to silence your inner
mom. Fail all the time.
All the time.
And the cool thing is that every episode ends with a hilarious roundup of the host parenting nails and fails
like
of
that.
The week. That sounds dirty. Like you've never fallen asleep on your baby's floor while your toddler leaves the house alone and cruises down the block.
Oh my God. That's actually
I can honestly say that hasn't gotten that bad.
But I want to hear that story.
I sure do. So guys, just subscribe and listen now to Nursing and Cursing on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. And find out why listeners say you will laugh, you will cry, you will thank God for these hilarious women who tell it like it is.
They're funny.
I mean, they sound like brethren, sisterhood, wives, similar people to us is what I was trying to say, and it came out all wrong. We love them.
Step straight.
Anyway.
Anyway.
Good day.
I said good day.
So anyway. you had a transition. We talked a little bit before, like we started recording about some of the stuff that you're doing now that has been like an extension of all the change you've gone through. Can you tell us a little bit about that and in the project that you are doing?
Yeah. So I mentioned my career in corporate healthcare. I left that in actually on leap day of 2016 because I didn't actually plan it that way, but I saw a meme that said, what are you going to do with your extra day this year? And I was like, I'm going to quit this shitty job.
I'm going to quit.
So,
I did.
Wow. Yeah. So
what are you going to do this leap year?
Yeah.
I can't wait.
God, please. Nothing. Honestly. Like it's been, okay.
Maybe just
don't
go to get a massage.
Her maybe. That yeah. meme this yeah. year. Sorry. Nobody send that meme.
Please don't. I mean, really.
Send you a gift certificate for a massage so you can't get the meme because you'll be too like zoned out.
That would be excellent. I'd save everybody a lot of pain. So, I resigned from that position. I wasn't sure what I was going to do next. My wife owns a coaching and consulting business. She's been a coach for many years, a couple decades, before coaching was trendy, actually.
When you say coach, do you mean like a life coach?
Yes. So she's a certified life coach. She's actually done a lot of work in the Enneagram, which is gaining popularity now. So she was doing that work independently. And I saw this posting for a startup nonprofit locally that wanted to connect women with mentors in our community, and sat down with them. And they were like, so we've got one $10,000 check and about four people who might want to be involved. Do you want to maybe see if you can make this happen? So I said yes, because apparently that's where, I mean, it was leap day for fuck's sake. I mean, why not? Just
for
kidding.
For fuck's sake. That's what I'm doing.
Yeah, that's just what I'm going to do, because I already did this. I already leapt. And so we spent the last 3 years building that program. Today it has over 750 women who've been matched cross industry in our community. It's amazing. It is an amazing, amazing program. So I got to build that the last 3 years, but in that process, my own idea came to me. It's called The Beautiful Project, and it's beautiful with two L's because it's not about beauty, but about an invitation to be full. It came really as a result of really an entire life experience for me of trying to fix my body or shrink my body. I've been at this size and I've been 100 pounds smaller than this. And it didn't matter what my body size was. The obsession was always there for it to be different. Mm-hmm. It was this moment I had with a physician. She offered to prescribe me speed. This was,
oh,
yeah,
great.
You know,
wow.
Super fun. End of 2017. Wow. So she,
Jesus.
God.
And I don't,
you were like, what is this? 1962? Right. Like, have you lost your mind?
Yeah. And in her head, she was helping, I suppose.
Of course she was.
Yeah. So
she should have given you some Adderall at the same time. You've been incredibly effective.
Yeah. Yeah. Something like that. The good news about that moment is that I had been doing some work. I had actually started to be kind of turned on to some people who are working in the anti-diet culture, fat positivity, in this movement, in this space of understanding that there were people who were living in large bodies who were actually just able to live and not spend their entire lives shrinking their body. And that resonated with me because I thought about sort of the sum total of energy and time and money spent on shrinking my body. And I was starting to come to this place where I was like, that's bullshit. I want to do something else with my life besides get smaller or try to get smaller. So I sat in my car with the prescription for speed in my hand and thought about my daughter. And I thought about the fact that right now her body looks the way that the world wants it to look, but it might not always. And she might sit in her car with a prescription for speed with a physician who says, come back every 3 months for liver and kidney function tests.
Oh
my God. And she would have a choice to make. And I thought about how I won't be sitting in the car with her, but I want my voice to be in her head, in her heart, in her bones. And then I thought about how my voice wouldn't be enough. So I, this line, I want to form a chorus of courage that can sing to her, and not just her, but all of our daughters and all of us and all of our moms, because this is like a lineage of shrinking stories. And so from that place, The Beautiful Project was born. It started as a place for me to write more, and then it turned into a podcast, and it's got live events now.
Is that the name of your podcast, by the way?
It is, The Beautiful Project podcast. They just launched season 3, and season 3 is, I called it The Mamas and the Makers, and it's about how women are a creative force in the world, how we take up space by way of what we create, and how what we create changes the world. It also changes us. And my line for that is, it's just ordinary women telling extraordinary truth, because that's what happens. Like, you set a woman down and just ask her to open up, and she just cracks open with the most beautiful things. And then I'm launching a gallery. So I'm inviting photographers to, if they want to do like a a body project specific gallery. We have one right now that I'm getting ready to put out there. And it was this woman who just wanted to bring 6 to 8 women in real bodies of all shapes and sizes. And she did a bunch of nude and semi-nude, and they're extraordinary. And they tell a story about women and how our bodies look different, and our bodies look different as they age, and how body diversity
is fine.
Yeah, she said, yeah, they do. So that's the, that is the work. So I just left that nonprofit at the end of 19 to turn the corner and spend all of my time and energy and resources into developing the project and amplifying the message from other stages.
I think it's great. And I think it's actually along the lines of our podcast, just representation matters. Representation matters. Seeing people that look like you really, really makes a huge fucking difference.
Well, and not being told that you have to be different to be healthy, happy.
Right, exactly. That too.
In
form. You know, I grew up, my mother was overweight my whole life, my mom, and I'm really, really, really protective of my mother, and I'm really protective of people who live in an overweight body and who struggle with it. My mom struggled so hard. I struggle with my weight too. I have crazy body issues too. But I'm so overly sensitive to the way overweight people are treated in our society and how we don't see it everywhere. It, to the extent that just the other night, I'm putting my daughter to sleep, and she asked me out of the blue, she goes, "Mom, do you like skinny or fat better?"
Ooh.
I said, "What? What? What?" She said, "Do you like skinny or fat better?" I said, where did you hear it? Where did that question come from?" And I think I came on really hard on her. I didn't handle it right because she shut down. She saw that I got upset by that question, and she wouldn't continue the conversation with me. I screwed it up. But it's because I have all these, but I have all these feelings about this stuff, and I'm so super hyper aware of people fat shaming everywhere. And I don't want my daughter to hear those conversations. I don't want her to hear fat shaming. And I was in Target the other day, and this is a happy thing, walking through Target, and they had plus-sized mannequins, and it was so great to see these bigger bodies in these clothes that they looked so good. Representation really matters.
Thank you. And I love the story about your daughter. Yeah. I think how we talk to our kids about bodies matters. People ask me a lot what I think about that and about what I think about talking to them about weight and their own bodies. And the thing I say all the time that I tell my own family is that all bodies are good. All bodies are good bodies. That's where we're going to start, right? So, and I try to come from a weight neutral approach because their bodies will change over time. I mean, I don't, you know, the reality for me is I don't know what my body would look like today had I not spent 2 decades in some version of disordered eating, honestly, like that.
Yeah. Yep. Oh, of course. Right. We all did.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
As a woman, I name a woman who hasn't dealt with that.
Well, I was going to say what I want more for my daughter is for her to learn body trust, that she can trust things like her hunger and her fullness, and she can trust what she craves, and she can trust herself to quote eat emotionally and understand that that there will be an end to that, and like all the things that we've demonized that are really a part of diet culture talk that you don't really see until once you see where diet culture is and how it operates, you can't unsee it. It's the toothpaste in the tube again, right? And it's freaking everywhere. So I try to have this like solid set of messaging that fat or skinny is irrelevant to me. All bodies are good. And we try to engage with like, what are your cues? And I want her to know she can trust herself. I want her to know that about freaking everything, right? And we're not taught that about anything.
Mm-mm. Yeah. Mm-mm. Well, and I think, I mean, I also have like a major food issue. And so, and I've talked about it regularly, and I've lost, you know, a significant amount of weight recently in the last like year or two. But like what you're talking about that I think is the most important thing is it's not about the weight or the number. It's about the obsession. It's about freeing yourself. Like, and that comes with an addiction to food, which is like the constant, like I remember walking down the street and thinking like, oh, if I had a magic knife that would like just carve out the fat where I wanted it to be. And like just insane thoughts, like walking down the street. And I thought that regularly. Mm-hmm. And, or like if I could eat this or not eat this, or, I'm not going to get the cake. I'm not going to get the cake. Oh, someone's talking to me. I'm not going to get the cake. I'm getting the cake. I'll just have a small piece of the cake. I'm going to have a little bit of the cake. All right. And then now I can have a second piece because I worked out like that train. And for me, it was like the weight loss wasn't about, it was about being in a body that I felt comfortable with, but it was more about being on a plan where the obsession yeah. wasn't happening for me. Like, I need to be on a plan in order to stop. Like, there has to be a judge and a jury that tells me to stop because I something's mm-hmm. broken for me that I don't know if I'm hungry yeah. on my own most of the time. I am an emotional eater, and there won't be a period where I'm an emotional eater. Mm-hmm. It'll be a forever thing. And then I just feel grosser, and then I'm mm-hmm. doing more, and it's a spiral. And like, I need a judge and a jury to be like, no, you had what you're mm-hmm. supposed to have for the day. And that frees me mm-hmm. from the obsession, but it doesn't change the conversations that have been handed to me from society Absolutely. About body and the way it should look and all that. Like, that's, you know, so those two things I think are critical.
Yeah. And I love that you're honing in on freedom, because that's ultimately what I'm talking about as well. You know, do you remember that movie, What Women Want? Okay. So he's jogging through Central Park, I think. And that whole right, swarm yeah. of women is, yeah.
Hearing all
and he's
women,
listening yeah. to their thoughts. And they're all obsessive, mostly about ways that they've screwed something yep. up or something's wrong, blah, blah, blah. And then there's the last woman who's counting the calories in her butter and in her toast. And that resonates yep, deeply mm-hmm. with me, right? And I had this moment there where when I think about that scene, because I know it's true for all of us, regardless of body size, you've already said that. I mean, I can't see your whole bodies, but I can tell there's differences in your bodies. There's a difference in mine. And we're all talking about the same experience of obsession around the size of our bodies and what we're putting yes. in to them, and always counting and always measuring. And the science supports, there is ample science that supports the fact that the most certain way to create an obsession about something in the human psyche is to restrict it. That's literally the most clear mm-hmm. path in the human psyche. So is it any wonder then that we develop over time a neural pathway that says, that obsesses about food? Because from our earliest memory, regardless yep. of body size, you're always trying to control it. And I will tell you that, I mean, for me, the freedom started when I threw out my scale. For the first time, and the thing I feared when I did that, of course, to release was my theory was, I'm this fat and I try this hard. What'll happen if I stop? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm, it turns right. out for me, what's happened is that for the first time in over a decade, my weight, I don't weigh myself. So I can tell by my clothes that my body has stabilized, and I'm just now getting to a place yep. where I'm adding like some pretty intense movement back into my, because I have to be careful, honestly. Like, the gym is the most triggering place in the world for me to go, I just need to fucking try harder, you know, back to that whole way of thinking.
Yeah.
So really what's happened for me is that I used to think about the things I shouldn't eat 1,000 times a day. What has happened for me is there is nothing I shouldn't eat. And suddenly I have freedom back. Like, and it wasn't suddenly, that's a lie. I still find it sometimes in my psyche. I'll notice that I'm like a human calculator for calories and macros, because I've spent my entire life paying attention to them, right? So I'll find myself doing this sure. like, oh, like you said, I can eat that because I worked out. I mean, I'm just trying to be gentle with myself. I spent 40 years saturated in diet culture. Of course, I'm still going to think that way sometimes. But what I crave for myself and for the women around me is freedom. Yep. And I just think we're here to do more than shrink. And I also think that when we spend mm-hmm. our lives obsessed with and consumed by the idea that we have to shrink our bodies, there's no way that's not spilling over into an invitation to shrink our voice, our ambition, our dreams. We can't be told to shrink one place and take up space in another. It just doesn't work that way. And if you think about some of the common things we hear women talk about, like how we apologize for our existence, like incessantly.
God. I'm mm-hmm. always saying to my daughter, don't yes. apologize to me. You didn't do anything wrong.
Oh,
I'm always saying that to her.
I'm a big culprit of the apology.
Yes. Yeah. So problem. I wonder what would happen if we just went, if we started somewhere. And for me, the starting point was in my body, where I went, fuck this. I'm going to take up space. It doesn't mean that mm-hmm. I don't care about my body or my health. In fact, the opposite is true. I'd like to welcome myself to a place in my life where all of my health is relevant. Not just the BM, mm-hmm. just not just my BMI, which incidentally was actually never developed for what we use it for. When you look at the history of the BMI, it was not developed to be individually applied to people. It was developed to look at global populations and what was happening globally. So, you know, we've just gotten caught up in all of these components of diet culture that incidentally it's a part of multi-billion dollar industry too. That
Of course. Yeah.
So there's all that at work. And I just think women are, I know I said it once or maybe three times, we're here to do more than shrink.
Well, that's why for me, it has to be, it's a food plan and not a diet. If it's a diet, I'm restricting and I'm like, so it's like, I can have a lot more, but it's like, I do have to be on a food plan personally. Mm-hmm. Cause that actually gives me freedom. When I'm not on a food plan, I'm an insane person. But whatever, I just think whatever it is that doesn't make you insane.
Yes.
And I don't know what, and you need to figure that out for yourself.
You do. And I think there are some places that we can start the conversation too, though, for women. You know, I was just telling the story recently. I was in the gym. I had been back in the gym for a couple of months. So before that I was walking and practicing yoga, and I teach yoga. And I mean, I've always moved my body, and I always will so long as I can. So I was back in the gym because it's really cold in Iowa right now, and it's difficult to walk outside. And so I was swimming, and so I'm in the locker room, and I'm getting changed, and there's this scale in front of me, and I watch 12 women walk by me and 12 women get on the scale. And if you can watch people's body language when they weigh themselves, it'll tell you everything you need to know about the scale and about what women believe about themselves. I watched one woman come back twice.
Yeah, she probably went to pee and then came back.
Yeah, yeah. Or took out her hair tie.
Yeah, took all her clothes off, came back just her underwear.
It makes me want to sit her down and like take her face in my hands nicely and say, that is literally just it. All that tells you is about your numerical relationship with gravity, and that's it. It's all it's telling you. It's not telling you anything else about who you are. And I think that's where I want to start the conversation with women. You know, I know that there's so much when it comes to the body positive movement, and which really started, honestly, kind of like you were talking about the way fat people are treated. And I use fat as a descriptor. Like, to be clear, I work really hard in my house too about the fact that it's a neutral descriptor. It's been used to hurt people, but it refers to tissue on my body. That's it. Body positivity started as a movement around equal rights, about dignity and human. It was a social justice movement in the beginning. It's since gotten co-opted and branded and all of those things. But really, it was about fat people, particularly fat women, particularly fat LGBTQ women, showing up and saying, this, you know, that intersectional feminism, I'm going to take up space here, and I'm tired of being told to shrink. You know, so I think that we can continue the conversation, understanding that's where it started, and enlisting all of us, because to your point, regardless of body size, I've yet to meet a woman who doesn't have a similar story, regardless of body size. So when it's all of us, that tells me we're like saturated in some bullshit soup that's telling us lies. It's got to be, it can't be all of us, right? Like we're all in different bodies. It cannot be all of us.
Yeah. I just saw this article on Medium the other day, and it made me so angry. And it was this thin person who was like, why don't you ask the skinny person? And it was basically like how she went out to a lunch and everyone was talking about weight and they wouldn't ask her. And she was just like, I have to work hard to maintain my weight. And I was just like, bitch, please. like it was just like, she, you know, I was like, you basically just did that. Remember that Slim Fast commercial? Rosie O'Donnell used to do a joke about it. She'd be like, have a shake in the morning, a shake at lunch, and then a sensible dinner. And she was always like, if I could have a sensible dinner, I wouldn't need your stupid Slim Fast. And it's like, if anyone could do what you're doing, skinny bitch, then we wouldn't be overweight. It's not your turn to talk. I felt like it's not your turn to talk. You don't struggle. Sorry. P.S. Sorry.
Well, one of the things I've discovered, because people, when you really start to say, I'm going to take up space in this fat body, people have a lot to say about that.
They take offense.
I mean, you know, the whole Lizzo, Jillian Michaels thing that a couple weeks ago, that's a case in point, you know.
Oh, well, people go after Lizzo so hard and because she dares to show her body.
And it's so offensive. And
she dares to claim sexuality and be sexy.
Exactly. And we're going to challenge her fitness level. I'm sorry. Have you watched her on stage? Like she dances and plays a classical flute. Most of us would fall over and die. Like you don't get to challenge her physical health in that.
Also, it's not your business.
Yeah, none of your business.
It's not your business.
Precisely. So one of the things I discovered, though, is that people, particularly people in thin bodies who like what we would what people in the fat positive movement would say are they're like concern trolls. Like, I'm really worried about your health.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ultimately, right. Well, the first answer to that is you know nothing about my health by looking at my body. You actually know literally nothing about my overall health by looking at my body. But when you really engage with those people who are viscerally full of hatred, I've seen it happen often. What the source of that is the person who is in a thin body, who's given up 80% of their life to be in a thin body, is pretty pissed that Lizzo's on stage seemingly enjoying her life in yeah, a larger yeah. body. They're like, give me, that can't be fair. I gave up all of this mm-hmm. yeah. to be thin. And now you're trying to shift the culture to say that we can all belong. Well, yeah, I am. So get over it and have a cheeseburger. Yeah. You're probably hungry.
Yeah, you're starving.
You're so hungry.
Eat some chicken. Yes.
All bodies are beautiful, guys. All bodies are beautiful.
Well, this was absolutely amazing. You will have to tell people, like, go through and tell everybody your podcast and where they can get through all of your stuff and all your connections, because people need to know you.
Mm-hmm. So the website is thebeautifulproject.com. It's beautiful with two L's. Don't forget that. It's an invitation to be full. We are on Facebook under the same handle, The Beautiful Project. The podcast is on Podbean and iTunes and Spotify. We're also on Instagram at The Beautiful Project. Also, I had the opportunity to give a TED Talk in March of last year. And so the TED Talk is called Stripped, The Art of Being Seen. It was a little intense. Spoiler alert, I take off my dress at the end on the TED stage.
Nice.
Atta girl.
Yeah, so that was a thing. But that happened, and that's real, and it's on YouTube. So that's really fun.
Maybe we'll just happen to include that link in the metadata.
I would not be sad about that. I do okay. want to invite people to that kind of freedom. So yeah, that's where everybody mm-hmm. can find me.
Oh, love it. That's wonderful.
This has been great.
Thank you so much. This was like, it was very intense, but
good.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah. I feel like I've been cleansed.
I know.
Thanks for having me.
Ooh, that was intense,
good
right?
Good stuff. Could have talked forever.
I just love that talk. I mean, it's just, we're all obsessed with our bodies mm-hmm. and about thinking about weight. And I just, the idea that she was saying that when you're so focused on that, that you become smaller somewhere else in your life, I thought that was really interesting. Mm-hmm. I've been thinking a lot about it since that interview.
So you agree with that now?
No, I don't know if I do fully. Yeah. I agree that when you are obsessed, then you're smaller somewhere else.
But you're smaller in so many other
ways. Right.
When you're obsessed
with
something.
I think I still believe that. I'm looking at it through my personal viewpoint, which is mm-hmm. that, like, I have a food addiction, so I can't not manage my food because then my life gets out of control. So that's where she loses me, but I think that's particular to me.
Right.
So yeah.
I know for me, if I obsess over my body, then everything is fucked.
Yeah.
Like, I can't.
But I can't stress
enough.
I have
to just accept what it is.
Yes. You know? But I can't stress enough, though, that for me, it can't be a diet. It has to be a food plan.
Right.
They're like rules totally. Are a way of living versus a diet. As soon as I go to a diet, I get crazy and obsessed, and exactly what she's talking about.
I
do agree with her. It's just a nuanced.
Food plans or diets or anything. I can't do it.
Yeah.
But I just have to accept myself and work out like a fiend and accept myself.
But if I start working out too much, like her, I start getting crazy too. So it's like, you know. Mm-hmm.
Working out is my therapy, so.
Yeah, no, it's what kicks the endorphins in and all that.
It's what makes me accept my body.
I don't know.
Anyway.
Okay, folks.
Anywho.
Let's keep this conversation going.
Yes.
Can you join us on the social, please?
Yes.
That sounds so sad. Just please
come join us.
Please. Join our Patreon community at patreon.com/ovariestalk. We got all kinds of extra content over there. And this week we're going to have a video from Sarah. A little behind the scenes extra content.
Don't want to miss it.
Mm-mm.
Also, you can find us on Ovaries Talk on Twitter, Ovaries_talk on Instagram, and If These Ovaries Could Talk on Facebook. And you can also join our community there and talk to other listeners, which is always fun.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's time, Jamie. It's time to say goodbye.
I guess so.
Okay. Eggs.
Ovaries.
If these ovaries could talk, they would say, X ovaries out.